I'm John, he's Patrick. Together we're the functional nerds. I'm John, he's Patrick. Together we're the functional nerds. Together we're the functional nerds.
Hello and welcome to the Functional Nerds Podcast. My name is John Anilio. This is hopefully the last week that we will be Patrick Hester-less. As longtime listeners of the show know, we batch record a couple episodes on a Saturday and Patrick is in the middle of a family emergency. I think everything is good now, but he had a very tough week and wasn't going to be able to join us today. Filling in for Patrick once again is Christy Cherish, has a couple great books out there and has a podcast of her own. And Christy, thank you again for filling in for Patrick.
Thanks for having me. It's my pleasure.
And why don't you, before we get started, why don't you tell people your website and your Twitter and all that stuff?
Haha. Well, they can find me at christycherish.com, K-R-I-S-T-I-C-H-A-R-I-S-H. And the Twitter handle's easy. It's just my name, Christy Cherish.
Awesome. Very good. And we are delighted to be joined by Victor Milan today. Victor is a prolific author, and he is the author of the Dinosaur Lords, which I am currently reading and enjoying very much. And just I think he has the best blurb of all time on the cover of this book, which is, it's like a cross between Jurassic Park and Game of Thrones. And that is from George R. R. Martin himself. So if that doesn't make you want to read the book, I don't know what is. Victor, thank you for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thank you for inviting me.
So yeah, so there's so many things that I'd love to talk to you about. There's you've got a lot of interesting things going on. I certainly want to talk a little bit about the book. We don't tend to get spoilery about books, but a little bit of my impressions of the book, which I'm enjoying. And you've led a very interesting, colorful, creative, productive, prolific life so far. So I know Christy and I both have tons of questions for you. But, you know, before we get into all of that, why don't you tell our listeners, first off, you know, where they can find you online, and then maybe a little bit, tell them a little bit about the book.
Okay. Online on Twitter, I am at Victor Milan is my handle, just all one word. And on Facebook, it's probably best to just do a search for me, Victor Milan. There are a couple of us, but I'm the one with dinosaurs. And I also have a website, which is, surprisingly enough, victormilan.com.
Awesome. Fantastic. And why don't you tell people a little bit, you know, I talked that blurb, and, you know, I am fortunate because of doing the podcast, I get all of these amazing books sent to me from Tor and from all the various science fiction and fantasy publishers. And when this one came up, this one went to the top of the pile. It's got a wonderful cover and wonderful title and a great blurb. And so why don't you tell our listeners a little bit of something about the book?
Well, it's basically set on a world, which is not Earth, in which humans and a few other mammals coexist with life forms, both plants and animal, that existed during the Mesozoic. The world is almost completely populated by those. The Mesozoic is the age of dinosaurs. And the society, the cultural level, is approximately that of Renaissance, about the 1500s, and minus firearms. And it's the story of people who find themselves caught up with forces that basically continue to escalate beyond their control, but they do their best to survive and make their way in the world. And of course, it involves lots of people riding around on dinosaurs, including, of course, knights. So
yeah, it's great. I have lots of things to talk about when we get to the main part of the interview, but I think that's a good taste of what the book is about. So let's, you know, we'll move on to our picks of the week. And before we do that, I just do want to thank everybody who is our patron over at patreon.com/functionalnerds. We have over 34 patrons right now. If you get some value out of the show and you enjoy what we do here, please consider becoming one of our patrons over at patreon.com/functionalnerds. So let's get on to our picks of the week.
Picks of the week.
Victor, why don't you go first? Why don't you tell us what your pick this week is?
Okay, I'm kind of new to this. I'm not good at keeping up with current works in the genre, I have to admit. I've just finished catching up on Charlie Strauss's Laundry Files books, for example, that have been out forever. But what I actually am interested in mentioning briefly is a book, not fiction at all, called The Motivation Hacker by an author called Nick Winter. And I am finding it very useful in dealing with my own issues of avoidance and procrastination in writing, which is a problem that I have, and I suspect a lot of other people do. So I would seriously recommend, yes, I seriously recommend looking into it. It costs $3 on Kindle, and I'm finding a lot of stuff that I'm actually using that's actually helping me focus on the enormous amount of writing I need to do. So that's it, The Motivation Hacker by Dick Witter.
Oh, I'd be sure to check that out. I love all those kinds of books, like The War of Art by Stephen Pressfield. I don't know if you've
read that one.
Yeah, that's a great one, too. And I'm always looking for stuff like that, so thank you. Great pick.
Yeah. Why is it that you think that writers tend to procrastinate? Because it's not just a singular or a couple of us. It's like every writer loves to procrastinate, almost. It's an exception if you don't.
Well, what he would say is that we have a low expectancy of success, and I think that's absolutely accurate. That's one of the potential factors in driving motivation is, okay, am I going to succeed? And I, a lot of times, find myself, even though I've written over 100 books for publication and have been doing this for over 40 years, which I'm sure is longer than either of you have existed, you know, I still find myself, okay, can I do this? I can't do this. This kind of stupid internal dialogue. And one of the ways that the book has helped me to handle that is to realize, well, that's low expectancy of success. It sounds like jargon, but I think it's a useful way of looking at it.
I agree.
Yeah, that's great. Yeah, I'm going to definitely check that one out. Christy, what's your pick this week?
All right. So I was going to go with a video game, and I ended up not going with a video game. And the reason is because the video game I was going to pick is The Witcher 3, and everybody's already playing The Witcher 3, so there's no point mentioning it. So I went with something else, Rogues of the Republic series by Patrick Weeks. And it's kind of got a bit of a video game theme with it. So the three books, The Palace Job, The Prophecy Con, and The Paladin Caper, which just came out and I'm reading. I think I have to say, like, it's something in the U.S. where I have to say that I did get that third book as, like, a freebie because I'm on another podcast. But it's – so it's a high fantasy caper, and the description, and I think it's accurate, is it's Ocean's 11 meets fantasy. So there's a lot – it's an incredible amount of humor. It's, you know, the sort of – the write-up for the series is from Amazon 47 North – is that the main character, who's Locke, is seeking revenge. And it would be, you know, it would really help if she wasn't in jail. So plan, it's to steal a priceless elven manuscript that once belonged to her family, but now is in the hands of the most powerful man in the Republic. To do so, Locke, former soldier, former prisoner, current fugitive, must assemble a crack team of magical misfits that include a cynical illusionist, a shape-shifting unicorn, a repentant death priestess, a talking magical warhammer, and a lad with seemingly no skill to help her break into the floating fortress of Heaven's Spire and the vault that holds her family treasures. So, you know, and what could possibly go wrong? So the highlight, so Patrick Weeks is the author. For video gamers out there, he's also one of the lead writers at BioWare, which produced Mass Effect and Dragon Age, and he's written on both those games. And this is his series, which is why I picked it up in the first place, and I kind of loved it. It's kind of got that Terry Pratchett humor, if that makes sense. Mm. And my highlights of the series are Locke always manages to steal a new and interesting sword, which is great. Kale has a brilliant set of your mother jokes. And the unicorn should be considered absolutely an abomination of the Lady Amalthea from The Last Unicorn. So in other words, awesome.
Great. Yeah.
Sounds great.
Yeah. Victor, I'm sorry. I cut you off there.
No worries. It sounds really appealing. I just put it on my wish list. Or my actually shopping list.
I think Black Friday shopping list?
Yeah. Yeah. Now, I think I actually have the first couple of books of that. Because doing the podcast NetGalley, we get a couple of those books. So I think I have a couple of those through NetGalley. My pick this week, I'm going to pick an album, and it is an album from 1978. It is by Al Di Meola, and it is called Casino. Al Di Meola is a fantastic guitarist. He played in a group called Return to Forever with Chick Corea. So this is very much 70s jazz fusion, and I'm a huge fan of that. And I've been listening to this album all week over on Apple Music. And Al Di Meola, you know, even though he played jazz, it doesn't sound all that jazz-like. It's very, he plays with a very distorted rock tone. He's got impeccable technique playing, you know, super fast lines. But what's one of the more appealing things about the album is there's a real Latin percussion vibe to a lot of it. And I know later on he like really explored that even more. A little bit of a Middle Eastern flavor to some of the tracks as well. And I'm of the opinion, even though I was just a very small child in the 70s, I was born in 1974, records never sounded better than they did in the 70s. Albums just were recorded and they sound so warm and so big. And unfortunately, we lost something as you know, time went on. And I love the sound of this record. So it's Al Di Meola, and it is called Casino. So Victor, that sort of leads me to one of the things I wanted to ask you, because in your bio, it says that you were Albuquerque's most popular all-night prog rock DJ. Is there truth to that statement?
Absolutely. It was, in fact, in 1974. And around that time, I saw Al Di Meola in concert opening for a group called Renaissance.
Mm. That is it. You know, what's really interesting about Renaissance is that I'll try to keep this, you know, brief, because I feel like Victor and I could probably go off the deep end with our prog rock talk. And we could talk a little bit about that. But I actually know the current keyboard player in prog rock is a guy named Tom Brislin, who is a dude about my age, like in his early 40s, I believe. And he played on a tour with Yes when Yes put out that symphonic album. Tom was the keyboard player then. It was like one of the times Wakeman wasn't in the band, but he's like a local guy here. And he is the touring keyboard player for Renaissance now, who are still touring. I don't know how many original members are left of the group, but Tom is on that album. And Tom's a great keyboard player. He's done tours with Meatloaf and with... I want to see the Blondie as well too. Anyway, so a little bit of thing, but I love all of that stuff. So what was, you know, what kind of stuff did you do as that kind of DJ?
Well, I got into it in the early 70s. I think about, I can't remember, I think it was about 73 that I got my job at a local station. It was KRST-FM, then Progressive Rock, now Country, oddly. And because I was a neophyte to that kind of music, to that kind of broadcasting, they stuck me on the all-night shift, and it turned out that I really throve there. I was able to do longer tracks and explore a lot of things, and I really loved the progressive or album rock style of music. A lot of people criticize it today for being bombastic, and I tell them, yes, that's why I like it. It kind of went from there. It was just something that fit, and people also seemed to like the sound of my voice. So I actually acquired a following. I've met people who were fans of mine way back then, which is kind of startling because it was 40 years ago.
That's awesome. And now, you know, can you, because I feel like there is quite a bit of a relationship between progressive rock and science fiction and fantasy literature. I think they kind of inspire each other in a lot of ways. What are your feelings about that?
Well, absolutely. I mean, if you look especially at covers, the Roger Dean covers, of course, for Yes and others spring to mind. They were massively fantasy influenced, and fantasy was obviously a huge influence on the music of the day. And at the same time, because I find the music inspiring and stirring and imagination fevering, a lot of my it has a lot of effect for inspiring images and interactions and characters in my own work. So yeah, I think there's a terrific amount of feedback or a feedback loop between the two of them. Yeah. And I know a lot of the musicians are in fact substantial fantasy and science fiction fans.
Yeah, and I think, you know, you also even see some collaborations as far back. I feel like Michael Moorcock did a little bit of lyric writing for, did you do it for Hawkwind?
Hawkwind originally, yeah.
Yeah, so I know there's that. And then more recently, you've had Kevin J. Anderson doing some various collaborations. He, with Neil Peart, of Rush.
Really?
Yeah, so they
did not know either one of those things. Wow.
Yeah, so I know with Kevin J. Anderson, he's been friends with Neil Peart for, you know, 30 years or something, since like the early 80s. And I think there's a couple of Rush songs in that period that are inspired by, I think, one of Kevin J. Anderson's short stories. And Neil Peart, being a big science fiction and fantasy literature fan, I know they collaborated on, so one of Rush's recent album is Clockwork Angels. So yep. Kevin J. Anderson did the, I think Neil Peart wrote the story and Kevin J. Anderson sort of did the novelization of the story, if I'm not mistaken.
I think you're absolutely right. I actually have that book on my shelf right now, an arc of it from Kevin J. Anderson, and I remember because Rush is one of those huge Canadian bands, right? Mm-hmm. So if you're Canadian, you end up, you have to know who Rush is. I think it's part of our school curriculum. Mm. But yeah, I've got the book on my shelf right now as a reviewable one. So I it's on my list very shortly.
Yeah, one of the other things that Anderson did, which is very interesting, which you may want to check out, Victor, is he did a book called, I think it's called The Edge of the World. It's a fantasy trilogy that came out maybe 5 years ago or so. And he wrote lyrics and had a collaborator in somewhere in Europe, I want to say Germany, and they did this progressive metal album based on that story. And I think it's called The Edge of the World is the name of the album. And I want to say it's called Roswell 6, maybe. I'll have to look that up and we'll have to put that in the show notes. But that's definitely a lot of good crossover there.
Interesting. I'll have to look that up too.
Yeah. So, you know, so that's one of the many things that going back into your past. But I know Christy had a question about your output. So Christy, why don't you ask that question?
So when I was sort of looking at your, you know, your bio and stuff, I noticed that you had like 100 books out. And then I was talking to John afterwards, and he was saying, yeah, he also writes under a variety of pseudonyms or names. And as a very new writer, I've only gotten my first books published recently, but the idea of writing under different names fascinates me and a lot of other new writers. How did that happen? Like, how did you make that choice? And is it something you recommend, like benefits and drawbacks and...
Well, that's an interesting question because the markets have changed, obviously, in 40 years. But at the same time, the motivation I had for originally, not for most of them, but for the first time I used a pseudonym, the first actual book I sold was a hardcover Western called The Night Riders. And because it was my lifelong ambition, functionally, to be a science fiction and fantasy writer, and I knew that at that time getting basically typecast in a given genre was a very real danger, I decided to use a pseudonym for it, even though it was my first hardcover sale to Doubleday. And so I used the name Keith Jarrod. And subsequently, I wound up doing most of my books that were under pseudonyms. They're house names for continuing series. There were franchise works, such as I spent the last 14 years or so writing for Gold Eagle Books, mainly in their Deathlands series under the name James Axler. And that's simply because, well, if you write books for those series, which is how I made my living primarily, you got the house name, although they were also very good about crediting who wrote which book. But there's Daniel Abraham, who's a friend of mine, who's most notorious, oddly enough, under the pseudonym James S.A. Corey, which he shares with Ty Frank, another friend, another New Mexico writer, has the habit of attaching a different pseudonym to different genres of works that he does. It's sort of branding within his own brand, as I think he would put it. In other words, Daniel Abraham does high fantasy. James S.A. Corey does space opera. MLN Hanover did urban fantasy when that was still a thing. Mm-hmm. And I think that's much to recommend. Also, I actually, by contract, I'm bound not to publish any possible competing works under my own name in the field. So if I branch out, say, into a space opera, which I'd like to do, it might wind up under a pseudonym. So I there are definite reasons to consider it as for a new writer.
Mm-hmm. Mm. No, very cool.
You know, and that kind of leads us to another thing I wanted to ask you about. You mentioned Daniel Abraham and Ty Frank. And so there's this amazing community that you're a part of in New Mexico with Daniel Abraham and Ty Frank, but also Ian Tregellis, who is one of my favorite authors. He's part
Excellent.
Of that groups. Yeah. And we've had him on the show, and he was a wonderful guest. His Milkweed Triptych is maybe one of my favorite series of recent years.
It's brilliant.
Yeah, and you know, but there's George R. R. Martin, and there's Melinda Snodgrass, and how did that group come about? It's like all these big heavy hitter writers that all live in New Mexico. So maybe you could talk a little bit about your experience with that group of people.
Well, it's actually kind of mysterious. I like to consider New Mexico the science fiction and fantasy capital of the known universe, because per capita, we have like 1.5 million people in the state. We have probably the biggest concentration of them of anywhere. And it started happening in the 70s. We had some homegrown people who were making moves into the field. Myself, Walter John Williams, whom you may have heard of, especially since he's guest of honor at WorldCon in Helsinki in 2017. Melinda herself. And then for some reason, a lot of science fiction and fantasy writers began to move here. I think the first, well, Jack Williamson was, of course, a fixture here. He moved here in the 1920s. And Roger Zelazny moved to Santa Fe in the 1970s. And one of the things that happened is an author named Tony Hillerman, who is a mystery writer who's unfortunately passed away but was a great guy, started a monthly lunch for New Mexico writers called First Fridays. And I took part in that. Melinda took part in that. And eventually it attracted Roger after he moved here, started taking part, which was where I met him and became friends with him. And Fred Saberhagen moved to town. George R. R. Martin moved to town. A bunch of them came in during the 70s. And while I don't remember Fred and George as ever taking part in First Fridays, I met them through Roger. So, and we've continued to attract new writers. We've also continued to grow a bunch of them. I mean, writers like Ian, who's not from here, but wound up moving here to take a job at Los Alamos, for example. And we just continue to accrue writers. And it is a bit of a mystery as to how and why. I myself like it here because it's weird. We have weird kind of alien landscapes, which I find beautiful. And at the same time, the culture is such an unusual mix for North America that it just, to me, fosters creativity.
And maybe you could speak to what that culture is in New Mexico.
Well, it was, of course, taken over by the United States in the 1840s, 1850s. It was a dominant Latino and Indian Native American community at the time, and they're still a huge factor in the state. I mean, when we moved here in the early 1960s, because I'm a transplant too, we moved to Santa Fe, and the state was about 40% Latino at the time, and Santa Fe was probably more. So we have these three cultures that kind of intermingle and both conflict and synthesize with each other, and it creates a cultural mix. We have this rich, for example, folk mythology. One of our most popular figures is La Llorona, the Weeping Lady, who is a mysterious figure who supposedly wanders the ditches lamenting, in the most common version, the fate of her children, which she drowned in one of the acequias or irrigation ditches, and who, you know, preys on the souls of unwary travelers like all of those folk figures do. So there's a lot of that going on. And then again, also when we moved to Albuquerque, again in the early 60s, it was a company town for Sandia Base and Kirtland, a Sandia Corporation, which was basically the kind of technological feeder for Los Alamos National Laboratories. And that attracts a lot of scientific and technical types.
Interesting. Yeah, that's amazing. Yeah, because whenever I see this, and we had Daniel Abraham and Ty Frank on the show a while back, and you know, we were talking a little bit about that group, and it's just I don't know. There's something about, you know, we were talking to Matt Kressel, who's in a New York-based writer, and there's a New York-based group called Altered Fluid that he is a part of with Rajan Khanna and N.K. Jemisin and a bunch of other big writers. And it's I'm always fascinated how these groups come together and how, because I always wonder, you know, it's sort of a chicken or the egg thing. Is it these very talented writers come together out of nowhere, or is it, you know, kind of an incubator for that kind of talent?
I think it's both.
Yeah, that's kind of what I was thinking too. You know, once you get enough people kind of together, it kind of helps to inspire and point people in the right direction too, I think. Christy, what's your experiences with things like that, with writers groups and that sort of thing?
One thing, you know, just listening to you talk about you know, about Albuquerque, Victor, it really sounds like, just that idea of the folklore and the science sort of mixed together just sounds like a perfect mixing pot for really good sci-fi and fantasy. But I don't know, like, I mean, there are some great writers in Vancouver. I think Canada has a very good, we're a little more socialistically inclined than the US. And so we do have fairly large national and provincial art programs, and they tend to be more geared towards the public. So our libraries will get in, we have something where our libraries do writers in residence, and our universities do as well. So we had like Spider Robinson come to the Vancouver Public Library, and he was their writer in residence. So he was paid to be the writer in residence for a while. He's a really well-known science fiction author in Canadian sci-fi author. And, you know, they were doing it was free. If you were in Vancouver or anywhere in Canada, you could write in and be part of a workshop, a podcast workshop he was doing. And it was completely free. You just had to submit some words. And I ended up doing that, which was kind of amazing. So I would say that's been my experience with writers workshops and things like that, is that I've been able to take sort of, I've been able to take advantage of that kind of stuff. And I think a lot of Canadians do, but just your workshop, your sort of writer's group, Victor, is kind of amazing, because it just seems to have formed.
It seems to what? I'm sorry?
It seems to have just sort of formed on its own without having any outside influences, which is kind of amazing.
Yeah, so a lot of us nucleated. I mean, we basically hung out socially for decades, a lot of us. And a lot of us nucleated in a role-playing group in the late 70s and early 80s, and that eventually gave rise to the Wild Cards Shared World Anthology series, which is still going on.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I it's just something that seems to have happened, and I've got to admit, it's great. I mean, it's great, you know, a lot of my friends are involved in this. It's a lot of my social circle.
Yeah. Now, you know, so that can, what I want to talk about now is your current book, The Dinosaur Lords. And you mentioned, and one of the things that I find very appealing about the novel is kind of what you said, that it's like Earth and particularly like Europe. And so there's sort of mentions to Spanish culture and French culture and Slavic culture and all different things. But with, you know, I think the title of the book, you know, and certainly dinosaurs are a part of it, but it seems like there's much more going on than just that. Now, what particular, you know, inspired this sort of kind of quasi-European setting?
Well, I decided I wanted to do a book with dinosaurs in them because I love dinosaurs. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to do a book with dinosaurs and people in them because people, your characters, are what drive fiction for me. Mm-hmm. And I find it hard identifying with dinosaurs, although I think there is one in the book that readers generally identify with, but she's an exception. So it kind of sprang from that. I started to envision characters. Now, I will also mention that the world, which is called Paradise by its inhabitants, only semi-tongue-in-cheek, is a wide and diverse world. There's a vast number of environments. There are also a vast number of cultures. It's just that the story, as it began to evolve in my mind, was set in a kind of analog for medieval and Renaissance Europe. And so that's where the first story is set. If I get to continue doing books set in Paradise, there may be some set in very, very different cultures.
Yeah, it's one of the things that I find really appealing about the book. One of the other things that I really like about this, which you don't see a lot these days, is there's some really wonderful illustrations of the dinosaurs at the start of each chapter. So maybe you could tell us a little something about those.
Well, that's just brilliant. Richard Anderson, whom I never heard of until the Tor released the pictures of the cover a year ago, is brilliant. I mean, he totally captured, as far as I'm concerned, the feel and substance of the book both in that cover. It is so dynamic and so visually striking and arresting. And my editor, Claire Eddy, who's excellent, who was originally raved about by Ian Tregillis, in fact, when he was with Tor, and whom I envied for years for having her, she got in touch with me and said, well, I want to try to get interior illustrations, so can you recommend some dinosaurs? So naturally I did. I didn't think she was going to succeed in doing that, because that's just unheard of. It's not even her province in the bureaucratic hierarchy of a publisher. She's in editorial, and that's art and marketing and this and that. But then one day she sent me a zip file of all of these fabulous images that the same artist, Richard Anderson, had done, and I was blown away by them. And I think they add an enormous amount to the book. Also, all my writer friends are jealous of them, because getting interior illustrations is very rare these days. I was astonished that Claire was able to do it.
And they come off well in the ebook as well, because I have a hardcover of it, but I also have an e-arc that I received of the book, and I've been kind of switching back and forth between the two. I do a lot of reading on an elliptical machine at the gym on a Kindle, and the illustrations come off great in the Kindle too. And I think that's one of the, and I don't know if that was a thought in terms of the interior illustrations, because they are kind of like a sketch kind of style with, you know, sort of just blacks and whites. So I don't know if that was part of the thinking behind it, so it would come off well as an ebook.
That may well have been. I'm not really privy to Richard Anderson's thinking on this. And, you know, he's the artist and I am not, which is my philosophy on this. And in this case, I think it's worked out fabulously, because he's terrific. The artwork, I think, is perfect for the book. And yeah, it's, he may even have had that in mind. I don't honestly know.
I think I'm sorry. Go for Christy. Sorry.
Sorry to interrupt you, John, but that actually leads into one of the questions I had for you, Victor.
Okay.
With the dinosaurs, and I've also got a science background, so this is why I sort of jumped on it. You mentioned sort of the Mesozoic era and stuff. Because it is fantasy, how careful were you, or how interested were you in keeping the different dinosaurs or archetypes that you used consistent with the eras or the ecosystems they would have been involved in? Or did you just sort of go on what was going to work for the story?
Well, it was a combination of both. I mean, I really, really try to keep them in ecosystems that will work for them and in the rough ecological balance. For example, predator versus prey. Mm-hmm. You have a lot more, well, massive prey animals than you do biomass of predators. I was also very, very, because what I'm, you know, I'm interested in dinosaurs. I'm not interested in this book in doing made up creatures that are dinosaur like. I wanted to do the dinosaurs that I love, actually, as they've evolved, because of course what we know about dinosaurs today is drastically different from what we were taught when I was a kid. But in terms of the geological eras, That was one of the reasons I make it clear at the outset that this isn't Earth, because creatures from different geological eras can coexist. We have a brief scrap between a Tyrannosaurus and an Allosaurus at the very beginning of the book, and that's something that was impossible by tens of millions of years in Earth history. Mm-hmm. But because I just wanted dinosaurs, and you know, I may even cheat in a few creatures like Dimetrodon, which was a pre-dinosaurian creature, just because they're exceptionally cool. So it's a combination of the factors. I go for as much realism in terms of setting and the actual descriptions of the dinosaurs themselves, but the needs of the story tend to drive a lot too.
Mm-hmm. Cool. You know, we took my son to, there's this like dinosaur park in New Jersey where they have, it's like sort of the animatronic kind of, you're walking through the woods, but then, you know, a Tyrannosaurus like pops his head out kind of a thing. And they actually look pretty cool. And my wife and I when my son went through his dinosaur phase, as so many children do, my wife and I would always talk. They're like, I think they're just making up dinosaurs now. Because when we were kids, it was a Tyrannosaurus, a Brontosaurus, and a Triceratops, and that was pretty much it. And now there's like millions of them. So I don't know if it's just we weren't privy to it, or if they just discovered new ones over the years. What is your feeling on that? Do you feel like they didn't really talk about it as much, 20 years ago, or do you think they have just discovered a lot of new ones?
Both to a high degree. I mean, the interest in dinosaurs has waxed and waned throughout their almost 200 years of known history. I mean, the history of the time they've been known to us. But it's never entirely gone away. There's always been some public fascination, but especially starting with Jurassic Park 20-odd years ago, the interest in dinosaurs started to revive. And a lot of the fact is we're truly in a golden age of paleontology right now. There is so much correlation, for example, of information that a lot of new species are being identified, a great many of them being plucked off the shelves of the basement collection of museums, where they were kind of stacked and misclassified or not classified at all. With the current body of knowledge and analytical tools that exist now, students can find those things and identify them with some degree of confidence and identify new species out of them. So we're in an explosion both of interest in dinosaurs and of knowledge about the creatures, including numbers of species known.
Yeah, that's amazing, and it's really obviously that's the title of the book, but it's really an enjoyable facet of it, where it gives because in a lot of ways the book does read as a very sort of traditional kind of epic fantasy with different nobles and knights and all that kind of stuff, and having the dinosaur, it feels very natural. It really does. So I'm really loving that aspect of the book so far.
Well, thank you. I put a lot of attention in trying to get them all to work together.
Well, mission accomplished, because I'm digging it. We're sort of running towards the end of our time here. So once again, Victor's book that is out now is The Dinosaur Lords, and it's published through Tor, and you can get it as a hardcover, and you can get it as an ebook. And I'm not sure if it's available as an audiobook yet. Do you know about that, Victor?
You can pre-order it now from audible.com. I found this out literally yesterday.
Okay.
And the release date, and it's being released on January the 26th of 2016.
Excellent. And I know there's a book two that's already scheduled. So when is book two going to be out in this series?
Book two, which also has a fabulous cover, is scheduled to be published on July the 6th of 2016 by Tor.
Excellent. So everyone should go and check those out. And Victor, why don't you, once again, tell us your website, tell us your Twitter, and if you're going to be going to any conventions upcoming, because I know a lot of our listeners frequent the conventions, and maybe they can connect with you there.
Well, the next thing I'm going to, which is something similar to a convention, is a New Mexican tradition called the Jack Williamson Lectureship at Eastern New Mexico University in Portales, New Mexico, where I'm the guest of honor in April. That's as far as I know, open to the public, although it tends to mainly attract New Mexicans. And a lot of writers, including Melinda Snodgrass and sometimes Ian Tregellis, Sage Walker, Walter John Williams, go to that one as well. I went to my first one this year and had a great time. Otherwise, right now I'm scheduled to go to Bubonicon, which is our Albuquerque convention in late August. And then Archon, which is a big regional convention in St. Louis at the very beginning of October. Those are the regular ones that I go to. If somebody wants to invite me out as a guest and pay for me, I'll be happy to go to other conventions, but my funds don't permit a lot of travel.
Yeah, that's always the trick, is if they pay for you, they're you're much more likely to go.
Yes.
Yeah, absolutely.
How that works.
Yeah, well, that's amazing, and it's victormilan.com and at Victor Milan on Twitter, I believe.
Yeah.
Excellent.
And I'm on Facebook as well.
Awesome. Very good. Christy, why don't you tell our listeners again what you have, your website and your Twitter and all that.
I've got, so you can find me at christycherish.com, K-R-I-S-T-I-C-H-A-R-I-S-H. My Twitter handle is the same, and I'm also on Facebook.
Yay.
I find myself more days, I mean, I still use Twitter a lot, but I found, you know, I know everyone likes to hate on Facebook, but I find it a better communication tool these days. Mm-hmm. I really do.
I do too.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think you could just get with those comments, they kind of last longer, and you can actually have conversation. Like, I guess Twitter's better for real-time stuff, but I'm not on Twitter all day. I have, like, yes. So this auto-posting thing where I post, so I'm sort of there, but I don't really manage it. But with Facebook, you can kind of, I don't know. That's I know that there's people tend to like or say they don't like Facebook, but I have to say I find it to be the platform that I kind of use more in terms of social media these days, so... I'm there as well. So, yeah, once again, Functional Nerds, if you enjoy what we do, consider becoming one of our patrons. We have 34 patrons at the time of this recording, and it means the world to Patrick and I. So if you get some value or entertainment out of the show and like to hear great authors like Victor talk about their books and other cool stuff, consider becoming one of our patrons over at patreon.com/functionalnerds. Victor, thank you so much for coming on the show. We really appreciate it.
Well, thank you so much for having me, and it's great to meet you and Christy.
Yeah, and we'll have to have you on again when book two comes out, and hopefully we can get Patrick back on the show then so you guys can officially meet. And Christy, thank you again for filling in. Very much appreciated, especially the last-minute nature of the filling in.
No, my pleasure, and it was great meeting you, Victor.
Thank you.
All right, everybody, have a great week, and we'll see you next time.
You too, John and Christy. Thank you.
Well, I'd like to say thank you on behalf of the group and ourselves, and I hope we pass the audition.
You're still here? It's over. Go home. Go.
Would you like a chili, baby?